I guess what's up? Welcome back to the podcast. We have resumed after a really long break, and the wait is all worth it. On the podcast today is Paras Chopra. Welcome to the podcast, Paras.
Thanks, Yash. Glad to be here.
We'll be talking about a couple of things today, right? So we'll be talking about being a generalist, and also Paras has written a 100-tweet long thread on Twitter about how money works. So I'll ask a couple of questions about that too. So yeah, without any further ado, let's jump right into it. All right, so Paras, I have this ritual, right? Like before, you know, the podcast begins, I have this ritual where I ask the guest, what was their business story? Like, how did, you know, Wingify came into existence?
Okay. So ever since my dad got me a computer at home, I've been hooked to programming. So I was coding ever since I was, say, 13, 14 years old. And around the same time, I came across essays by Paul Graham, who runs this accelerator called Y Combinator. Mm-hmm. And his essays on startups really struck a chord with me. And I just kept diving more into early, say, successes on the internet, which were really, say, companies like Google, PayPal, Yahoo, and so on and so forth. So I'm really talking about 2005-ish, 6-ish. Sort of a period. Mm-hmm. That served as an inspiration, and then, you know, I knew that I had to be an entrepreneur, a tech entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. And during my college, I kept trying to do multiple startups. They kept failing, and that's how sort of I reflected on why they were failing, and marketing or lack of it came out as the main reason why they were not working out. And finally, I started learning about marketing, and Wingify then happened because I was interested in marketing, I was interested in coding, so I just thought, let's make a tech startup within marketing. So that's just very high level background of how it came out to be.
All right, you know, it's really interesting. You started coding at 13 and 14, so I'm, you know, around that age right now. So how was learning code at that point, like when you were 13 and 14? Because right now it's like, you can go on various platforms and whatnot. Like, how was the case back then?
Back then, my first introduction to programming was Visual Basic 6.0. I'm not sure if you've heard of it, but it was like one of the first, not one of the first, but back in those days, a very equivalent of those recent no-code tools that you see around. Mm. So it was very drag and drop. You could make buttons, you could make labels without writing a lot of code. So all the graphical user interface was made in a very visual manner, and the code was basic, you know, which is easy to learn. So the stepping stone to my sort of journey was this creation tools, which are also emerging today. And I felt, you know, if the first step was harder, I may not have really jumped into it with that much enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm. All right. Right, so, you know, you talked about, you know, starting up in college and whatnot. So you said you ran a couple of startups and a lot of them failed. Can you like tell me what mistakes that you made? Like one, like a prominent mistake for like a, you know, decently big startup that failed in college.
It wasn't as much of a mistake as it was. I mean, in retrospect, it's a mistake. But I think what happens is that you subconsciously end up building for problems you're aware of, and that's why my initial startups were an attempt to solve problems that, say, only college students would have. And that is not a good market, because the college student market doesn't have a lot of disposable income. So the range of the problems you're aware of when you're 15, 16, especially within the college environment, they are very limited. So in retrospect, you know, solving those problems were not a great way to build a company, because this audience was A, limited, and B, they didn't have a lot of disposable income. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I won't call it a mistake, because it would have been incredibly hard for me to empathize with problems of, say, outside world people who work professionally, because I had never done that. I was a college student, so.
Okay. So were you a freelancer before, like before starting in college?
No, not really. I mean, I had done very few projects, but I was more interested in academics. So I was going to institutes for research internships, and I was writing papers. So I was also very interested in academics, so didn't get a lot of time for freelancing.
Oh, all right. Like, how did you build a team at that point of time? Like, those startups, how did you build a team? And how the team is, like, different right now at Wingify?
I mean, back then, the team was, again, you know, friends or friends of friends. And I remember back then, there was this unconference called Barcamp. So I used to go there, and you'd bump into lots of similar-minded people at Barcamp. And you'll get to know those folks, and they became, and all of us are working frankly part-time because we had the college together. And obviously now Wingify is not a part-time project. We are 250 people at Wingify, so things are very different now and then.
Mm-hmm. How's the culture at Wingify?
What do you mean, how's the culture?
You know, a lot of companies have this, you know, new office culture. Like, they have some sort of a motto that all of them running, some sort of, you know, and an idea that everybody has in their head while working, so that everybody gets their work done.
I mean, in that sense, you can say what we're inspired by. What we're inspired by at Wingify is to create world-class products. And the reason for that is, I mean, it's not an empty aspiration. It's because we compete. I mean, most of our clients are from outside India, 95% or more. So in that sense, we compete in a market with global companies. So we compete with Google because they have a product in the market. We compete with a couple of other companies. So in that sense, you know, when customers purchase products that we build, they really don't care where we are based out of. So in that sense, it truly competing at a global scale, and that's what inspires us. You know, based out of India, can we create a world-class product and a world-class company? And that's what all of our aspiration is.
All right, like for the people who don't know, like, you know, can you just tell us like what Wingify actually does?
Sure. So Wingify makes a product called VWO. VWO was the world's first A/B testing tools that made it very easy for marketers to set up different versions of their websites and e-commerce stores and figure out which version works. So very simply, an A/B test is where you have two different versions, A and B, and you make a change in one of the versions, say B version, and you see how your clicks, purchases, or other metrics get impacted with that change. So VW lets marketing teams at different companies do those changes without being excessively reliant on the IT team, because then that interaction slows down. So when we launched in 2010, that was the innovation that really helped us grow our company. And like I said, you know, today we're 250 people doing more than 20 million in annual revenue and completely bootstrapped, which means we've not raised any external funding.
Yeah. All right. Like, let's talk about the initial days of Wingify, right? Like, how did you manage to build a team at that point of time? And how was hiring back then, and how is hiring back like right now?
I mean, initial hires always come from people, you know. So it was always the college network, people you worked with at college, and so on. And today, obviously, we have a recruitment team, but still we find that, you know, our sort of best hires are from networks. So it always ends up being like a function of having like a good network, or at least not like a wide network, but having worked with interesting people in the past. That makes it easy for you to hire.
All right. Let's say I come tomorrow at your office for like a hiring interview. What would you look for in me?
It depends on role. So obviously role is a big factor, and it also depends on what level you're hiring for. So obviously for entry level, people haven't really sort of chosen a career per se. You know, there's lots of open-ended paths for them to go. What's most fundamental is I think two things. One is really their sharpness. You know, we want to work with people who are sharp which is, you know, really a proxy for analytical, logical, so on and so forth. And second, I think we want to hire or work with people who are humble in the sense of, you know, not feeling that, you know, they've they know everything that they should know. So I mean, I'm not calling it in terms of say growth mindset, because for us, growth mindset that doesn't come with humility, you know, it just makes it very hard to work with. So so really that humility and that respect for others is what we look for.
All right. Have you ever made like a hiring mistake in the past?
Yeah, lots of them. Hiring is really hard, and tons of hiring mistakes.
Okay, can you like narrate a couple of low incidents, like how a bad hire influenced, you know, the entire team in a wrong way?
I think higher up in the hierarchy, the worse the impact of a bad hire, which means if you're hiring someone who's going to lead a team of 50 people, hiring that person wrong is going to have a much worse impact than if you're hiring an individual contributor who ends up being wrong for the company. So, I mean, this is, and I think one of the interesting things is that there are no common patterns in bad hiring. Every bad hire is sort of a bad in a new way. Otherwise, you know, you improve, and you don't sort of tend to make similar mistakes. But since there's so many variables and dimensions to people, it's easy to keep hiring bad people for a very long time.
All right. No, let's come to firing people, right? So I had to fire someone recently. Not a really good experience. Like, how do you guys deal with firing people? Let's say like in the initial days, how do you guys, you know, how did you fire people at that point of time?
You mean the process of firing them or the process of deciding who to fire?
Deciding.
I think that is actually simple. The if you have, I mean, at early stages especially, if you start feeling that someone isn't adding value, or if you're deciding whether to fire someone or not to fire someone, I think I've always seen you should fire. And I think firing is the wrong word, because that establishes a one-way relationship. It's really a two-way fit, wherein the person and the company might not be good for each other. And firing also means it's a person's problem and issue, but that's not always the case. It could be that in the company, what company wants to be, what company culture is simply not the right thing for the person. So the day you start feeling that it's not probably working out is the day you should decide to let part ways, right? I've seen people dilly-dally on this for a long period of time, and ultimately they come around to the same decision of letting person go. But that just wastes a lot of time on the person's behalf and on your behalf. So if you have doubts, you should just decide then and there. I've seen very few doubts resolve over a period of time. They just grow over time.
As in doubts grow over time, like problems go growing if you don't fire people like that?
They don't get automatically resolved. So frustration remains.
Alright.
Because I do believe people changing themselves in a short period of time is very difficult. So if a decision, your frustration about someone not working out is because of their work ethic, because of their motivation, or even because of skill, people do change over a long period of time, but at the time scales a startup or a project needs to work at, you wouldn't see, you know, magical transformation in a short period of time.
All right. You know, let's come back to Twitter, right? So why Twitter? Like, you're sort of an influencer on Twitter, do you really like Twitter, or you're doing it because, you know, you got followers after a point of time?
I mean, you get followers if people find what you're writing interesting.
I mean, sure.
I'm not writing something interesting because they are followers.
Sure.
It's actually the other way around. Yeah, for me, it's just a way to express the thoughts I keep on getting every now and then. And what I love about the platform is the conversations I have there. So there are people who will tell me where I'm mistaken, or people who will build on what I'm saying by suggesting an article and so on. So it's really like a knowledge enhancing platform for me. And that's what I love about it.
All right. Do you feel like Twitter is untapped?
I feel in general, not just Twitter, in general, the sources of learning and education are untapped. Even so many amazing lectures on YouTube, so many amazing, I mean, you could listen, this would have been impossible, Steve, 20, 25 years ago, where if you wanted to listen to Nobel Prize winners, what would you do? You'd have to wait for them to come on TV or maybe a City Today. I think you can fill your entire day listening to what amazing thinkers have to say, and I think that's highly underrated.
All right. You know, you wrote this, you know, really long essay on money, right? How money works. I had a couple of questions about it. Like, one question, you know, even I asked it on the tweet as well. The question is there really something else which is that form of a, let's say, a shared reality like money, other than the night sky for humans? Like, how this shared reality really works? How do people really accept money?
It's the same way people accept religion, right? It gets accepted because everyone derives benefits out of it, and I think that's the simplest explanation. There is a structure or a system where an association into that system benefits everyone. That structure gets bootstrapped automatically. So that's the same with religion. That's the same with money, and in fact that's the same with democracies as well, right? We have a set of things we believe in and they're beneficial to us, so keep on believing them.
Like initially when the idea of money was invented, like, was money a social construct back then?
It was actually not. I mean, I think looking at money as an invention was the wrong thing, because that suggests that someone, you know, one day thought that money will be a great idea. This thing is just naturally evolved. And like I said in my thread, money is not a specific thing. It's a commodity which bad people happen to use for exchange because, you know, it's just convenient and durable. So in fact, you could use literally anything for money if a set of people agree upon. And that agreement is not very explicit. It's not like everyone goes to a town hall and say, let's use this for money. It just emerges very organically through the choice of, you know, what do you use to do transactions. So it's not so much of an invention as much as it is, you know, emergence.
All right. Do you feel like the idea of money will fail anytime in the future?
Again, that's a very binary sort of a question. I think there won't be a binary answer to this. For some things, they'll become so cheap that money will not be relevant anymore. And I think some of those things are cheap already. Say, accessing information, or Twitter, Wikipedia, and lots of things are so cheap that money plays no role there. But at the other hand, whatever is limited and desirable, like maybe a stay at a luxury resort, which you cannot just infinitely replicate, or for there you'll have to, because I mean, if you have 100 people but only one of them can access it, how do you make, who accesses it? Ultimately something like money will sort of determine, if not money, but it'll be something else in proxy of it. But it'll be always, you know, something which few people have a lot of, but other people have a few of.
Yeah. Can like money bring in problems? Like excess of money, can it bring in problems in the future?
It depends how excess of that money is brought about and how it is distributed. If magically everyone's bank account number doubles tomorrow, nothing will change. It's just a unit, right? Instead of say 100 rupees, you can have 200 rupees, but everyone has 200 rupees, then nothing really changes. But if excess of money is given first to a few privileged people, maybe like bankers or others, they obviously use that to their advantage. And that comes with a host of problems because someone else gets disadvantaged because of that. And that's what also happening at a lot of places where more money has been put into the system because of COVID pandemic. Mm. And that will benefit the privileged a lot more than the unprivileged.
Yep. I guess the third or fourth thread you mentioned, like how barter system failed, right? So can you just elaborate on it a bit more?
Barter system, that happens when you're exchanging. For example, I have a pen and you have a glass bottle and we exchange it. That's barter, right? And barter system changes because there's so many things in the world and so many people making different things. So the chances of two people who want to barter having exactly the same things that each one of them wants from the other is almost nil. So that's why it doesn't scale, because you most likely will not have what I want and I won't have what you want. And that's where a common sort of commodity like money, that's a problem it solves, because we both agree we can exchange it for something we want with someone else.
All right. Let's come back to the topic of being a generalist, right? So, I have an idea, like, why do people become generalist, and, what's the idea of, being a generalist? So, I'll say that first. You can correct me where I'm wrong, and you can tell me your idea. Right. So, according to me, like, being a generalist is knowing a bunch of skills so that you sort of become a Swiss Army knife. And let's say you're in a company, and then you can handle multiple domains in your own company by not essentially leading them, but, watching over, seeing that everything is okay. That's what I feel about being a generalist. Is it like right, wrong? Like, what's your view?
A generalist is someone who is able to work across different subjects just because that person has mental models that spans across functions, right? I think generalist is really like a function of a person being very curious about how the world works. So I do feel it's less of a choice. You probably cannot choose to be a generalist. It's more of an inclination. And if you know how the world works and your mental models are very wide and flexible, you'll obviously be able to add input to different number of functions. Whether you can lead it or not is another matter, but at least you will have useful inputs for a variety of functions within a company or otherwise.
All right. Let's say someone wants to be a generalist in a tech field, right? Like, what are the essential skills that person has to learn? And what mindset should he ideally have?
The person should read a lot and read very diverse. Because like I said, being a generalist is about having very wide and flexible mental models. So the whole point is to be able to add. I think being a generalist just means being able to talk to anyone without being boring. So if if you're able to sort of get to that stage, and getting to that stage just means very wide amount of learning, that would be my advice, right? Just be curious about everything under the sun.
All right. Let's say you're talking to someone who has just passed middle school, right? Like, what is that one skill that you want a person to learn?
Reading and making notes.
All right.
That would be the single most essential skill. And frankly, I don't know whether that is something which people can choose or whether they're just inclined to. But if someone is willing to put work, I would say reading and making notes from what they're reading so that they retain better is the skill they should absolutely master.
All right.
And reading widely. When I say reading, reading as a skill deployed for non-fiction books, but different types of nonfiction books, right from physics to economy to biology to computer science.
All right. Like, how to develop an interest in a subject, like let's say interest in a subject or a field that a person wants to learn.
Actually, to develop an interest, I would pick the best educational resources that are out there and just get started. There is a wide variety in terms of the quality of explanations that you find at different places. So on a subject, no two explanations are alike. Some are much better in terms of giving you a good understanding. And when you have good understanding, you become naturally motivated. So I would spend a lot of time researching what are the best professors for a particular subject, what are the best websites for it, and start from learning there. And once those professors do their magic in terms of explaining you very simply and clearly, you'll automatically have motivation to learn more and more. But on the other hand, if you end up reading something which is very badly explained or obscure, your motivation will die down then and there.
All right. So, you know, a couple of months ago, right, like, there was this huge controversy about Whitehead Jr. teaching coding. Like, I wanted to really want your view on it, because you run a tech company and, you know, you probably know, like, is it right or wrong to choose Whitehead Jr. as a, you know, code teacher for a 8-year-old, 5-year-old? What do you think?
I don't know a lot about that, frankly, so I can't comment. I just know that there are a lot of good sources for learning coding freely available, that are freely available on the internet. So I would personally not choose it. But again, you know, I come from a background that I understand not a lot of parents would have. So so again, it's really hard to take a binary sort of opinion here. Context matters so much.
So a little what I feel, right? Because see, I sort of disagree with the fact that code should be sort of formally taught at the age of 5, because code is almost like a language, right? Like, and most probably when someone learns a mother tongue, they just learn by, you know, trying it out, like listening to the same thing over and over again and trying it out. So I think that should be similar with code, right? And at 5 years of age, like formally training someone to learn code where the person doesn't know how to say, you know, talk in English properly, would it make sense? What do you feel?
I don't see, I mean, that is a separate question from Whitehead Jr., right? On this question, I disagree with you, because code to me is, I mean, it's an essential, it's a way to express yourself.
Yeah.
And I don't see any age being like debilitating when it comes to not being able to learn it. So if you're able to learn addition, multiplication, in class 5th, you're able to learn poems and so on, why not code? And of code also has a wide range of sort of complexity, right? You don't have to write compilers at standard 5, but you can definitely write very simple games.
All right, I'll sort of rephrase that question again, right? So initiating, when you start learning a language, when you just initiate learning a language, do you think formal education is required? And if we take coding as a language, like similar to English or Hindi, something like that, do you think formal education, while just starting it, is required?
Lots of kids are able to do a great job without formal education. So when it comes to formal education, no, I don't think formal education is required, although there are advantages of formal education, especially which comes to being embedded in a peer environment. So I do feel interaction with peers is essential, but the traditional syllabus-driven formal education, not so much.
All right. Do you fear automation?
Fearing in the sense of increasing global inequality in the short term, yes. But otherwise, I welcome automation in doing a lot of things which humans probably shouldn't be doing anyway.
But like, what are your biggest fears of automation? Like how automation can go wrong? Because I have a general idea about how it can go wrong. I want to first hear your idea about it. How automation can go wrong, everything can just be in the wrong place.
I mean, it is increasing global inequality.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that is, if people are displaced without sufficient social security because they work out automated, that is automation going wrong in my dictionary.
Mm-hmm. All right. Like on an individual level, how do you combat automation?
I think you have to continuously. So the top sort of, you know, say 5th percentile of any job, it's again, the top ones are the ones which either do not get automated or are last to be automated. Because for any job at the top percentile of performance, there is tons of nuances, tons of threats. And automation first addresses the lowest common denominator in any job. So take any job and the simplest aspects of it will get automated first. So in any individual job, and I'm talking in a very job agnostic manner, being top of your field will likely help you combat automation, or will likely, you know, help you be ahead of automation.
All right. Like, what field do you think is the most in threat because of automation? According to just like a prediction.
It's not a field, but a nature of field. And again, the fields where the work does not vary a lot, even though work can be extremely hard, or you know, extremely work, individual pieces in that work could be extremely hard, but if there is a pattern in the work, no matter at what level and how complex, that is likely to be automated. For example, say lawyers and maybe even doctors. The types of patients and the types of cases that they see, if those are recurring, those can get automated. But when it comes to, for example, programmers or say, I would even argue probably say teachers, for example, they are less likely to get automated, because every time they have like a new student to interact with, it's sort of like someone who's personalizing things each time they're doing is less likely to be automated.
All right. So as like a programmer, right? So what I feel is things or jobs which have like very specific rules and very specific data sets that can be automated. Do you feel that's right?
I mean, that's one way to look at things, but again, that specific rules can be very complicated. So today's AI and automation is just very good with learning rules which could become very complex. But if these rules are applicable again and again and again, then they can be, for example, diagnosis of a disease can be extremely complicated. But if that diagnosis happens again and again and again, patterns, no matter how complex, can be learned, and hence that job can be automated.
All right. At last, could you tell me what was the biggest mistake you made in business and what you learned from it?
I guess one of the biggest mistakes was not to pay attention to how important sales and marketing is. So being an engineer, product and engineering came naturally to me, but marketing and sales, I should have started focusing on it much early in my 10-year journey than I did. We had a first salesperson, I think, in our 4th year, and should have done that from day one, because it's absolutely important for scaling the company's growth. And the sales and marketing people do bring in skill sets that you as engineer or you as a technical person may not necessarily have.
Thank you so much, Paras. Thank you so much for being here. I'll link Paris's Twitter handle.
Thanks, Yash.
Yeah, I'll link Paris's handle in the description down below. You can follow him. And if you like this podcast, do the formalities, and we'll meet next time. All right. Bye, guys.